All right, so we're going to pick up in the end of chapter 13. We talked a lot about the Passover last time. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the crossing the Red Sea. Let's start reading in chapter 13, verse 17. Then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near, for God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. So that's an interesting statement. Lest perhaps they change their mind. Didn't God know what they were going to do? Yeah. He's trying to head off at least one complaint. Right? So God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under solemn oath, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. By the way, we mentioned that when Joseph actually said that when he was dying, right? That take my bones, and when you leave, when God delivers you, take my bones with you. This is mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11 as a sign of Joseph's faith, right? Hebrews 11 is all about faith, right? It's faith of, it goes by faith, you know, Noah did this by faith and so forth. And it goes down the line of all these great men of faith. And that is the incident that Joseph is remembered for in that chapter. So what was he thinking about? He's dying. He's a ruler in Egypt. Right, he's second only to Pharaoh. He doesn't ask them to build him a giant pyramid, right, like the Egyptian kings did. What did he say? He said, just plant me over here, but when God delivers you, when God brings to pass what he promised, dig me up, take my bones back, and bury them in the promised land. That's a sign of faith, because What does being buried in that place in the promised land imply? We know that Abraham bought a parcel of ground to bury Sarah, and then eventually Abraham was buried there, Isaac was buried there, Jacob, when he died, they had a funeral, right? They took him back out of Egypt, took him back to the promised land, buried him there, next to Abraham, Isaac, and so forth, and now Joseph saying the same thing. What does that imply? Jews have done this to this day, by the way. I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you go to the Mount of Olives outside of Jerusalem, almost the whole mountain is covered in graves. What's that? It's the promised land. Yep. Right. But what were they looking for? For the future. They were still looking for the fulfillment, right, of the promises that God made to Abraham. And part of that promise was the inheritance of the land as an everlasting possession. Hebrews says that Abraham died in faith, not yet having received the promise. But in fact, at the end of chapter 11, after it lists all these people of faith, it says, these all died in faith, not yet having received the promise. They're looking forward to the fulfillment of the promise, which implies resurrection. Right? Didn't we all celebrate the resurrection last Sunday? Why did Christ raise from the dead? Why does Paul say that Christ was the first fruits of all those who have fallen asleep? What does the resurrection of Christ prove? That this is not just a fable. That God's promises are not empty. Right? They're not just figurative. All these people died in faith. They were all buried in this place because they were looking forward to the resurrection, when the dead are going to come forth out of their graves and God's promises of this kingdom are going to be fulfilled. It's an important thing, and that's our hope, isn't it? That's our hope. God raised his son from the dead to give the apostles a tangible proof of what's to come for all those who are obedient to God, all those who follow him and are devoted to him and his covenants. All right, it's tangible proof, which is why, you know, Jesus, when he rose from the dead, he says to his disciples, "Handle me and speak and see. A spirit doesn't have flesh and bone like you see I have." Right? It's tangible. The resurrection is tangible. And that's what's going to happen for all those who are faithful to God. All right, so verse 20. So they took their journey from Succoth and camped at Etham at the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light so as to go by day and by night. Now in chapter 14 for just a moment, verse 19. It says, "The angel of the Lord who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them, and the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them." So who's in the pillar of cloud? The angel of the Lord is in the pillar of cloud, right? And we see this several times in the account of the Exodus and the account of the Israelites in the wilderness. If you just keep your finger here, go over to chapter 33. I love this chapter. It's very interesting. Verse 1. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Depart and go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought out of the land of Egypt, to the land of which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your descendants I will give it, and I will send my angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite, the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite.'" So the angel of the Lord is going to go and lead Israel, right? Leading Israel out of Egypt, leading Israel across the Red Sea, through the wilderness, eventually into the promised land. And then if you go down to verse 7, it says, "Moses took his tent and pitched it outside the camp, far from the camp, and called it the Tabernacle of Meeting. And it came to pass that everyone who sought the Lord went out to the Tabernacle of Meeting, which was outside the camp." Now this is Moses' personal tent. All right, this is not what they built later, which was the tabernacle, you know, that had all the fancy furniture and all that kind of stuff in it. Moses took his tent. He pitched it way out there. And people, if they needed to seek God on something, they went out there to Moses' tent and they sought the Lord. They prayed. "So it was whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle that all the people rose and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he had gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. All the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshiped each man in his tent door. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend, and he would return to the camp. But his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Then Moses said to the Lord, 'See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me.'" So Moses is leading Israel, but Moses is essentially saying, "I can't do this by myself," right? "You're going to send somebody with me to lead Israel." So what does he say? "Yet you have said, 'I know you by name, and you have found grace in my sight.' Now therefore, I pray, if I have found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you and that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people." And he said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Now what's fascinating about that statement is the word presence here in the Hebrew language literally means "my face will go with you." It's literally the word for face. All right, "my face will go with you." And if you look at Isaiah, just keep your finger there, go to Isaiah 69, I think it is. No, it's not 69. There is no 69. Isaiah, I think I may not be remembering this correctly, but hang on one second. Maybe it's 63. I think it's 63.9. Mm-hmm. Yes. He says, verse 8 says, "For he said, surely they are my people, children who will not lie. So he became their savior in their affliction. He was afflicted. The angel of his," literally face, it says presence here. The Hebrew word is face, it's the same word. "The angel of his face saved them. In his love and in his pity he redeemed them, and he bore them and carried them all the days of old." So Isaiah here, he's prophet. He's, of course, he's way after all these events, but he's remembering what God did when he brought them out of Egypt. And so what does he say? Who went with Moses to lead Israel through the wilderness to the promised land? It was the angel or the messenger of God's face. Who do you think the messenger of God's face is?
Jesus.
Yeah, it's the same messenger who appeared in the burning bush. It's the same one. He's leading Israel. Now, they didn't see him most of the time. They saw a pillar of cloud. They saw a pillar of fire at night. But God's presence was there in the form of his son, who spoke to Moses face to face. That's what the scripture says. The pillar of cloud came down to Moses' tent door. And Moses standing in his tent door, looking at a pillar of cloud, and he saw the Son of God, and he spoke to him face to face. And this is the one who led Israel during that entire time. If you just flip back again, backwards to Judges. I know I've mentioned this before, but I think it's a really important concept for us. Judges, sorry, I think it's chapter 2. This is, of course, now the book of Judges is after the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, after they enter the promised land and they've defeated the enemies of Israel, you know, like God said he was going to do. And then in chapter 2 of Judges, it says, "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I led you," notice this, "I led you from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you." Whose covenant? The angel of the Lord, who is the Son. You know, we look at Israel, we look at the Old Testament, we think of, okay, well, that was God dealing with Israel. It's more than that. It was the Son of God leading Israel step by step, fulfilling his promises, demonstrating his power throughout the Old Testament. And in the New Testament, he comes in the form of man. He becomes human. And he's leading us and guiding us, right? And giving us his law. The parallels are pretty profound, and most Christians don't really understand this. They think, well, the Old Testament, that was the Father only dealing with the nation of Israel. It doesn't really concern us. We serve Jesus Christ, his Son. He was the one leading Israel. All right? So there's a lot in the Old Testament that's very relevant for us, because it shows us what God loves, what God hates, what God values, all these things as his son is leading his people. And so those lessons, that's why this is so important, all right? Because those lessons that we learn from the Old Testament are applicable to us as we're following Christ, all right, in the New Testament. All right, so let's get back to chapter 14. "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying," we're in Exodus, by the way, chapter 14. "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdal and the sea opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, and the wilderness has closed in them. Therefore, I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Let's skip down to verse 9. So the Egyptians pursued them, and all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, his army, and overtook them camping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth and before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us out of the land of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it be better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Can you believe this? Okay. God just got done with all these plagues. Killed all the firstborn of Egypt. He spared his people. Right? Here they are. Pharaoh finally says, let them go. They get to the Red Sea. And they're already saying, Moses, you brought us out here to kill us. The Lord doesn't care about us. He's just going to kill us all after he did all that. It's pretty remarkable. This is the first incident, but there are many, many more incidents of the Israelites ignoring what God did in the past and complaining about their current situation. And God puts up with it for a while. But after a while, he starts dropping the hammer on them, big time. All right, we'll see that. All right, so skip down to verse 13. Sorry, not verse 13, verse 15. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward, but lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. What? This is a phrase we see many times. We've seen it several times in the past, but that they will know that I am the Lord. That's a pregnant statement. It's loaded. They will know that I am the Lord. I mean, they just know his name. What's... Right, because his name means I am that I am, right? The one who is completely self-sufficient. I need nothing. I don't need... I have no one who created me. I create everything else, right? His name literally points to the fact that he is almighty, that he is all sovereign, that no one can say anything or do anything against him. And that's what it means to know that I am the Lord, okay? Because all these other false gods, the gods of the Egyptians, They all had their mythology associated with them. They had their pantheon of gods, and supposedly, you know, this god raped that female god and produced this offspring, and then this goddess now has a authority over this part of nature, and all these stupid myths. If you've ever studied mythology, it's ridiculous, especially Greek mythology, but the Egyptians were just as bad. Right, they had all these things about how these different gods supposedly originated. This god, the one who has power to bring all these plagues, to kill all the firstborn, and now to part the Red Sea, this god created everything, therefore everything must obey him. Right, that's, and really, this is, you know, the Bible talks about the fear of the Lord is the beginning of
wisdom.
Good. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And as we'll see as we continue, one of the things that God wanted to impress on the Israelites from the very beginning is to fear him. And a lot of there's a lot of Christians who say, oh, we're not supposed to fear God because, you know, he's gracious and he forgives everything and I can, you know, go out and commit adultery because God will forgive me, right? I'll just ask for forgiveness later. No, God has limits. And this is one of the things that the Old Testament teaches us unquestionably, that God is a very gracious, kind, generous God. But if you push him too far, you're going to find out what it means that I am the Lord. Right? I am the Lord. Because he does drop the hammer. And we see this over and over and over and over again. All right, so where was I? I got off on a tangent. So Moses lifts up his rod and he parts the Red Sea. Verse 19, and the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. The pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So instead of leading Israel, which the pillar of cloud, and who's in the pillar of cloud again? The messenger of the Lord, right? Who is the Son? He's the one who's leading them as they follow. Now they're backed up against the Red Sea, and what does he do? He moves and goes around behind them. Now he's between them and the Egyptians, right? So it says, so it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud of darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left, and the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud. So he's in the pillar of fire and cloud. And he troubled the army of the Egyptians, and he took off their chariot wheels, so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned, covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained, but the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the land of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, so the people feared the Lord. There's that phrase. They feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. Now, it'd be great if that was the end of the story, right? Not the end of the story. Well, chapter 15 is the Song of Moses. There's two Songs of Moses, by the way. There's Song of Moses number one and Song of Moses number two. This is the first Song of Moses. This song is all about how great God is, what a great miraculous thing he did to deliver us out of the land of Egypt. It's very much a praise, worshipful kind of a song. We get to the end of the books of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 32. That's the other Song of Moses. After 40 years of Israel seeing God's power and then turning against God and complaining against God and moaning and groaning against God and disobeying God, after 40 years of all that nonsense, we have the second Song of Moses, which God commanded Moses to teach to the children of Israel so that they would remember it for all their generations. And that song is about how wicked the children of Israel actually were. It's in Deuteronomy 32. You can read it sometime. He constantly is telling them how that he displayed all his power, but they turn away from him. They turn away from him. They turn away from him. And he loads it with threats as well. And some of it's actually quoted in the New Testament, by the way. The Apostle Paul quotes from that second Song of Moses. Something interesting, this is just a little caveat, in the book of Revelation, when it's talking about the end times, and it kind of gives the scene in heaven as to what's going on in heaven while all these plagues are happening on earth. It talks about God's people who are being persecuted, singing the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb. And they're worshiping and they're praising God for all of his mighty works in that. Well, that is referring to this. This is the first Song of Moses, praising God for all the mighty things that he did when he brought Israel out of Egypt. And so the people who are being persecuted by Antichrist and all that stuff in Revelation, they're singing this song. But it's called the Song of Moses and the Lamb, who is Christ, right? Because Christ is actually the one who brought them out of Egypt. It's pretty remarkable. Anyway, so we're not going to read the whole thing. It's a pretty long song. But you can read it when you have time. Kind of the way we are, though. When God does something great, God does something fantastic, we're all about praising and worshiping God, right? It's the same people who, not long after, you know, start worshiping a golden calf, they start complaining, they start griping against God, there's no food to eat out here, there's nothing to drink, you know, and all the nonsense that came after that. Here they're praising God. What short memories. Isn't that right? What short memories. But you know, it's true of us too. It's, you know, we think, oh, those Israelites, what stupid people they were. Yeah, we all do it. We forget what God has done. And this is why, you know, this is really important. Why this Old Testament is so important, because it reminds us constantly of what God has done. And I love the Psalms too. When you read the Psalms, what is David constantly doing when he praises God? He remembers his works of old, right? He remembers them and he recounts them and he recites them. If we don't keep these things in the forefront of our thinking, if we don't keep telling our children about what God has done, if we don't keep showing them what God has done, this is why, you know, God established the feasts. Passover was one. Some of you were there. This is why it was important for them to keep the festivals. What did the festivals do? They told a story of God's mighty works, right? And they told the story of what God said he's going to do in the future. If we don't keep these things in our minds by whatever ways are necessary, reading and studying is important. We don't keep these things in our mind. You know what happens to our faith? It declines. Because why? We forget, right? Our memories are short, just like the Israelites. Our memories are short. And so we begin to move farther and farther and farther away in our thinking from God. You know, one of the important lessons in the Old Testament with Israel is that God has really two reactions when his people forget and start to move away from him. He has two reactions, one of two reactions. You know what they are? First, he drops a hammer on them. He warns them and he hurts them. Okay? He hurts them. Hebrews says, whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. Right? He hurts them. You know what the second one is? When that fails, he leaves them. And I don't mean he forsakes them entirely. He withdraws his presence from them and let them just suffer the consequences of their waywardness and forgetting the importance of who he is and what he's commanded. It's one of those two things. If you're going to draw near to God, you have to understand that there are consequences to drawing near to God. The consequences are he's not going to tolerate disobeying his commands. Right? He does it for a while. He gives you warnings, but he will judge. In fact, when Paul's in 1 Corinthians, when Paul's talking about their Passover or Last Supper, whatever you want to call it, when they were Christians were observing that, he talks about the fact that some were coming with a flippant attitude. They were not being consistent with the biblical teachings when they gathered together for that, what we call the Lord's Supper. And so Paul says, because of that, he says, many among you are sick and many have fallen asleep, meaning they died, because God brought judgment on his own people. And this is Christians. This is the church in Corinth. You know, when the Pentecost came and God, you know, the Spirit of God came to dwell in the churches as his temple, you know, the church is called the temple of God. His Spirit came to dwell there among his people. And one of the very first things that happens is Peter's, you know, in the early chapters of Acts, Peter's preaching and things are going great. People are being converted. People are being baptized. And things are happening. Well, this guy named Ananias and his wife Sapphira, you know that story? Because some people were all excited about what God was doing in the early years of the Christian church. They started to sell off some of their land that they had so that they could donate it to those in the church or to give it to the apostles to distribute to those who were suffering and in need. And so this guy named Ananias and his wife, they had a lot of land. And so they decided, let's sell off our land and let's bring the money. But what we're going to do is we're actually going to just bring part of the money, a little bit of the money, and pretend that that was all we got for all this land and give it to the apostles. They brought it to Peter. This is in the early chapters of Acts. And Peter says, you didn't lie to men, you lied to God. And Ananias dropped dead on the spot. Then his wife came in, and Peter says, did you sell the land for this much money? And she said, yes, we did. We sold it for that much money. Again, lied. He says the same thing to her. You didn't lie to man, you lied to God. And she falls down dead, and they took her out and buried her. Now, for those people who think that, well, God was severe in the Old Testament, but for us as Christians, God's not severe, I got news for you. He can be very severe in the New Testament. And he set an example with those two people. He set an example. And the example was, just like back in the Old Testament when, you know, he established the priesthood and Moses told Aaron's sons that God says, you know, you can't bring any fire into here on the altar of incense. You must take fire from the altar of sacrifice, bring it to the altar of incense. You must do it exactly this way. And they were flippant about it. And they just went into the temple and or tabernacle and, you know, brought in other fire. And you know what God did to those two guys, Aaron's two sons? He burned them to death right there. He burned them to death. That was pretty severe. I mean, that set a precedent at the very beginning of the priesthood that you better pay attention to what God is saying. He is very, very serious. If you want to be part of this, if you want to be part of God's covenant, if you want to worship God, if you want the benefit, all the benefits that God brings to his people, you better be very serious and you better fear the Lord. Well, for the same reason, he did what he did to Ananias and Sapphira at the very beginning of when the Christian church was being established and the Holy Spirit came to dwell there. It was the very same thing. He's setting a precedent of how serious he is. But unfortunately, we tend to be forgetful, flippant, You know, and so I want to close with one passage. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I've mentioned this before. And it bears mentioning repeatedly, actually, because I love this passage, because what the Apostle Paul did here is he reminds us of these stories that we're talking about, right? The story of God delivering his people out of slavery, about him going with them with the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire, and how he parted the Red Sea and all the blessings that he promised them, how he gave them manna from heaven for 40 years. He gave them water out of the rock, which is in the next couple of chapters in Exodus. Paul's reminding the Christian church in Corinth about this history. And this is what he says. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate of the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples. Not right? These things, what we're studying, became our examples. That is, we are to learn from that. To the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. That was the incident of the golden calf, by the way, which comes in the next few chapters in Exodus. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted. The Israelites tempted Christ because he was in the pillar of cloud. And were destroyed by serpents. You probably know, remember the story of all the people who God sent serpents into the camp and bit a bunch of people. Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, verse 11 is the critical statement. Now, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the end of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. What is that saying? It's saying God's going to treat us the same way he treated them. That's what it's saying. Right? When they became God's covenant people, and God provided all the blessings and, you know, bringing them to the promised land, all that kind of stuff. This is our example. These are examples of how God deals with all kinds of things. Complaining, rebellion, worshiping other things, you name it. Disobeying his commands. God deals with it. All right? And like I said before, and I'll close with this, God will do one of two things. This is the message of the entire Old Testament. God's going to do one of two things with his people when they disobey or they treat the things of God lightly, or they are constantly complaining. He will either bring judgment, or eventually, if that doesn't work, he will remove his blessing, remove his presence. Doesn't mean we're not his people, but it means he's just not going to show up. You know, we come to church to meet with God. That's why we should be here. We come to church to meet with God. We come to church to meet with God's people, to be taught, and to hopefully go out and be obedient. And sometimes, as we see with the examples in the Old Testament, God's presence left his own house. It left. So I'm just not going to be there anymore because of all this stuff that's happening there. And it got so bad, at one point he sent Nebuchadnezzar to to destroy it completely and just to level the whole place, take them off into captivity. All right, these are examples. This is what the Bible is telling us. These are our examples. Learn from them. Let's learn from them and let's understand how to please God and what really ticks him off. Right? That's why it's here. That's why these things are important. That's why studying the Old Testament is important. All right, so let's close.